Good morning. My name is Barbara Park. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Barbara Park, and my pronouns are she, her, hers. I've been a member of Prairie for 40 years. I currently serve on the program and the search committee. And in better times, in normal times, I'm also the choir director. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We strive to be welcoming to all, though we recognize that we are all have biases that limit our understanding of how others may perceive us. We stumble in our efforts, but we commit to keep trying to grow our ability to love people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, and abilities. During the virtual coffee hour at the end of the service, we invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. We'll also have joys and concerns during that time and then break into small groups for more discussion and general chatting. We have a few announcements. We're sharing our offering this quarter with the Tenant Resource Center, and the link is in the order of service. Or you can go to Prairie website and click Give. Virtual Dungeons and Dragons is every Tuesday and Friday evenings. Thursday Fun Night this week starts at 6:30. Everyone's welcome to attend. Note that it's a new day and time moving forward. Saturday at 10 a.m. is the women's group, Women's of Wonder. That's our Prairie Women's group, and we invite and encourage all women to join us. And next Sunday, the service will be Robin Lowry Langton's talk on raising anti-racist kids and grandchildren. So our chalice this morning is going to be read by our speaker, Doug Kraft.
May the flame we light be a reminder of the mystery and the light that is each of us separately and all of us together.
Feel free to light a candle or chalice. And now we're going to have a moment of silent meditation. Now we're going to have a story for all ages. That is not a good idea. By Mo Willens.
That is not a good idea, by Mo Willems.
What luck! Dinner! Excuse me, would you care to go for a stroll?
Sure!
That is not a good idea.
Would you care to continue our walk into the deep, dark woods?
Sounds fun.
That is really not a good idea.
Would you care to visit my nearby kitchen?
I would love to.
That is really, really not a good idea.
Would you care to boil some water for soup?
Certainly, I do love soup.
That is really, really, really not a good idea.
Would you care to take a look at my soup? A key ingredient is missing.
That is really, 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 really not a good idea.
Oh, a key ingredient is missing. Yo.
Oh, my.
Well, we did try to warn him.
The end.
more soup, children.
So our presentation today is Listening Deeply, Befriending the Heart-Mind by Doug Kraft, Reverend Doug Kraft, and it's related to our third principle, acceptance of one another and encouragement in spiritual growth in our congregation. Doug Kraft got his degree in psychology at the University of Wisconsin, where he knew Bob Park, which is why we found out about Doug. And they lived together for a while at the Friends Campus Center there. Then he went to Star King to become a Unitarian Universalist minister and a psychotherapist and meditation teacher. He's published several books on Buddhist practice. He has two sons and two grandchildren, lives in Northern California near the American River with his wife and cat. So welcome, Doug.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for including Lila, our cat. I always like to say that I like living in an interspecies family. So it's wonderful to be with you all, even if this environment still feels a little strange. Turning towards, relaxing into, deepening and savoring. So this morning, I'd like to talk about these three phrases as a form of deep listening. We can't hear deeply in others things that we can't hear in ourselves. So these three phrases outline a strategy for listening deeply in many life situations. They are helpful in light-spirited moments, and they're particularly valuable in difficult times when we're discouraged or hurt or sad or lonely or stressed. This past year has been more dire than any time I can remember, certainly my lifetime. Pandemic, racial inequalities, economic breakdown, insurrection, climate change, sociopathic president, degradation of political discourses, and on and on and on. There are great opportunities in difficult times and loosen things up so we can sometimes move more quickly, for sure. But first, we need ways to be with our individual and collective angst. So this morning, I want to focus on deep listening to ourselves so that we're better able to listen deeply to the world around us. And the strategy I want to explore is summarized by these three phrases: turning towards whatever life brings us internally or externally, relaxing into any tension that we find inside, and then deepening, looking beneath the surface to the subtle underlying roots of our experience. What's underneath our experience can be different than how it manifests on the surface, so this deepening process is important. And when it goes deeply enough, it turns into savoring. So my shorthand for all this is turning towards, relaxing into, deepening and savoring. These practices are about how we relate to ourselves. And I'm not suggesting that self is something that we are, or even something that we own. I'm proposing that our sense of self is really, it's really a traveling companion. Who and what we are is completely mysterious, but we all have this itinerant chum that we hang out with and call me. We don't have full control of our thoughts or feelings or the self that moseys along with us. Just to take a simple example, right now, don't think about a blue panda. Is there a blue panda in your mind now? Did you put it there? I don't think so. I put it there by uttering the word blue panda. Can you push it out of your mind. Good luck with that. So we have influence on our thoughts and feelings and moods and walls through us, but we don't have full control. And if we don't have control of them, then they surely are not us. They are a companion. My subtitle this morning is Befriending the Mind Heart. I'm suggesting that our sense of self arises out of our biological wiring and out of our history, and that we can enrich our lives by cultivating a clear and kind relationship with a sense of self that travels around with us. But before I make all this sound esoteric, more esoteric than it really is, it might be helpful to just give you an example of how we can deepen this relationship through these practices of turning towards relaxing into deepening and savoring. Most years, I lead a 9-day meditation retreat, during which I meet with each meditator, yogis we call them, meet with each yogi or meditator every day so we can fine-tune and practice. Well, there's only enough time in a day to meet individually with about 18 or 20 people, so these retreats fill up pretty quickly. So several years ago, I invited another teacher to co-lead with me. I'll call her Jill. Together, we could accept twice as many people. Several months before the retreat, when we were almost filled to capacity, Jill had an epiphany. Her epiphany was that she could not lead with me. She didn't want to have a long conversation with me about it, but she wanted me to understand her thoughts, so she sent me this long email. Her basic concern was that she didn't think I was tough enough. Retreats provide a rare opportunity to go deeper, and she felt it was important to get yogis to work hard. My experience has been that for every yogi who doesn't put enough effort into the meditation, there are about 20 who work too hard at it. Over-efforting makes the body and psyche stiffen. But if people back off and let go of the mind's stories, there's a natural peacefulness that can emerge. On the other hand, she thought that my easy and awake style would lead to mellow mush, not the clarity and precision of the Buddhist practice. Furthermore, she thought that our divergent styles would be confusing and discouraging for yogis. And she said discouraging people was, in her words, a mortal sin. That was really just her tongue-in-cheek way of saying she felt very strongly about this. Well, since she didn't want to discuss it with me, I just sent her a short note. I said that I was disappointed that it wasn't going to work out. However, if she felt that working with me would violate her integrity, I understood that she had to withdraw, and I wished her well. Doesn't that sound mature of me? I thought it sounded mature and clear and accurate, and that it would bring some closure. Well, it didn't bring closure. In my next meditation, my mind rumbled incessantly. We already have more people than I can manage alone. Divergent styles are enriching. The Buddha himself taught different people in different ways. Grumble, 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 grumble. I was angrier than I realized. So I ignored the content of the rumbling and turned towards and relaxed into the anger itself, relaxed into its very center. And as I did that, it intensified. So I kept turning towards the resentment, relaxing into it, radiating kindness out into the world, only to have my mind go into another outburst. Well, I believe from years of practice that if awareness can get to the subtle conditions underneath, the tension would release. Yet after several days, my mind was still nitpicking furiously. I was stuck. There must be something I was missing. So I opened up more. And as I went more deeply into my feelings, I began to feel hurt. Deepening into the center of that hurt, there was a softer tenderness. And in the center of that tenderness was loneliness. I felt unseen. It seemed ancient, intolerable. But it was clearly there, this deep and familiar feeling of abandonment. So I relaxed into the core of this loneliness. Deep listening. A week had gone by now. I was still turning towards, relaxing into, and yet the rumbling and nitpicking persisted and morphed into this loneliness. So I let go of the label lonely and sunk into the felt sense of my experience. It was as if I was a piece of bamboo, hard on the outside, but hollow, dark, and dusty in the middle. And as I let down into the hollowness, a thought trickled up. The thought was, maybe Jill is right. Maybe my practice is mellow mush. Maybe my teaching and practicing are all wrong. The way my body responded to this may be surprising. A chuckle arose, and I smiled. This was the root condition of the root conditions of the root of the entire episode. I doubted my own practice down underneath it all. Worry and doubt come very easily to me, even if they hide in the shadows. My body chuckled more as it resonated with the truth of this. It was such a relief to expose the doubt at the core of my disturbance. And instantly, I knew exactly what to do. I didn't have to think about it. It was obvious. I'd conduct empirical trials. I'd practice a little harder and notice the effect. Then I'd practice a little softer and notice the effect. I didn't require anybody, any friend, any colleague, anyone else to tell me what was optimal. Frankly, I didn't even care about my own opinion. I just experiment and find out directly in my own experience. And suddenly, I didn't care what Jill or anyone else thought. I had doubt about my practice and a sure way to address the doubt. I almost laughed out loud. And I was so grateful to Jill for stimulating the inner environment that helped this clarity to surface. And as I meditated, my body and mind became very deep and peaceful, as everything faded but awareness itself. And this deep calm enveloped me. Turning towards, relaxing into, deepening and savoring. Do you see how this works? This example is superficially about meditation. I spend a lot of time these days meditating or mentoring meditators. But turning towards, relaxing into, and deepening are simple and subtle and universal enough to be effective whether you meditate for 5 hours a day or 5 minutes a week. So I'd like to unpack these practices and reflect on how to use them in all kinds of situations. And as I do this, I'll give you a little bit of background about where these practices actually come from. Most scholars and students of Buddhism agree that the Four Noble Truths, the so-called Four Noble Truths, are right at the core of Buddhism and Buddhist practice. But the four aren't capital T truths. Rather, they are just simple meditation instructions based on some really very practical observations. So I refer to the first three as the three essential practices. In the Buddhist text, the first truth, or the first essential practice, is literally translated as, there is suffering. Suffering is to be understood. Notice it doesn't say life is suffering. Buddhism is misunderstood that way. It just says life has suffering. Is this news to anyone? Is there anyone here who has never suffered, never hurt or lonely or felt sad or angry or discouraged? I don't think so. So it's actually a simple, it's even an obvious observation. Life has suffering. What's important is not the observation, but what to do with it. Suffering is to be understood. Understand here doesn't refer to an intellectual analysis, but to direct intuitive knowing, deep listening. If we understand a friend, we know what lifts her up, what brings her down, what she yearns for, how she views life, and so forth. The Buddha said that we need to understand suffering deeply and intimately, like we might understand a good friend. We aren't going to understand suffering if we're busy trying to fix it, or rise above it, or push it aside, or distract ourselves from it. To understand a person or a process or ourselves, we first have to turn towards it, open up, and take it in on its own terms. Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher, wrote, "Imagine an awareness that sees into the heart of suffering with no urge to change it. And imagine this awareness is the opposite of indifference. Imagine this awareness is the essence of love." When we observe pain, suffering, angst openly, let's open up to it. We see that tension is a common element in all of it. In the Buddhist text, in the Pali, the word there is tanha. Without tension or resistance of some kind, we might experience strong sensation, but we don't actually suffer. So the second truth, the second essential practice, is literally translated using a very dramatic verb. Says there is tension. Tension is to be abandoned. You just walk away from it. How do you abandon tension? Relax. The tension might be physical or emotional or mental. It doesn't matter. We simply invite it to soften and relax. Translating this into English can be a little confusing because the verb relax in English oftentimes has an aversive connotation. Relax, man. Let it go. Push it away. Aversion is the opposite of turning towards. So I like to translate the second practice as relaxing into. We relax any tension, but it's not as a way to distance ourselves from it, but as a way to open more deeply into it. We relax into our angst or into our anger, fear, yearning, or grief, like I did with Jill with my experience of her pulling away. This relaxing into allows us to see more deeply into the experience of hurt or or grief or stress to better understand it. The third noble truth, or third essential practice, takes this a step further. The language in the text is, Nirodha is to be realized. Nirodha refers to a deep sense of peace and well-being. Realize means to make it real. To let it be real, it's not enough to superficially see what's going on. We need to see into the core. We need to see deeply what's going on underneath our experience. So, for example, if we turn towards and relax into our fear, our hurt, or heartache, what do you see? Underneath it, almost always there's a tenderness. If we aren't tender, if we were emotional brick, we wouldn't suffer. So anytime we feel distress, there's some tenderness underneath it. And then if we relax into that tenderness, there's some openness or spaciousness in there. Without that openness, there would be no tenderness. And if we relax deeply into that openness, we may experience freedom, or at least a taste of freedom. Well, we all want this freedom, this inner peace, this spiritual aliveness, this openness of being. But too often we look for it by turning away from our difficulty, hardening against her, distracting ourselves. But it just doesn't work. Well, actually, it can work in the short run for a little bit, but it doesn't work in the long run. In the long run, that's a dead end. To find the deepest well-being, we have to turn towards, relax into, and deepen through our experience of difficulty. So the only path that works out over time goes through the suffering, the tenderness, and the openness. Into the openness rather than do an end run around this. So rather than fix, transcend, rise above, or push aside our difficulties, we can turn towards, relax into, and deepen. And when we go deep enough, the deepening turns into savoring, and we just let that well-being soak into our bones, like I did with Jill. In fact, when we turn towards and relax into, sometimes a sense of well-being comes up right away. If so, we just savor it and let it soak in. Just let it soak in. What if what comes up is uncomfortable? We turn towards and relax into and deepen until we experience the tenderness and the openness underneath. Imagine an awareness that sees into the heart of suffering with no urge to change anything. And imagine this awareness is the opposite of indifference. Neuroscientists have found that we are about 4 times more sensitive to pain than well-being. It's an evolutionary thing. You imagine 2 ancestors a million years ago walking down a path, and there's a cave bear over there, and there's some fruit over there. The one who's more tuned into the good feelings ignores the bear, eats the fruit, and gets eaten by the bear. The one who's more sensitive to the pain deals with the bear, maybe attacks it, maybe runs away, but tries to deal with it first and comes back and gets the fruit later. We inherited his or her genes. Since we're more sensitive to pain than well-being, the Buddha suggests that when we experience even a little bit of uplift, even a little taste, it helps to realize it by deepening into it or savoring it and just being with it. So in just a few minutes, I'd like to open it up for questions and comments. But maybe before we do this, would you like to try these practices out for a few moments? Okay, if you would, I think the rest of us are going to do it. So if you don't, you can find a book. But if you'd like to just join into this, think of some situation in your life that you're uncomfortable with. Could be something big or small. It might be in relationships or emotions or how you feel about the world, what it's like to be cooped up in a pandemic, or some sense of failure or let down. It could be anything that pulls your spirits down. And then close your eyes or let them come to rest someplace in distraction and bring to heart some of the experience of suffering in your life. Don't try to think about it or analyze it. Those can be helpful in some situations, but our thoughts can also be quite gullible. So instead, just feel yourself into the situation by simply turning towards it in your mind and heart. And opening up to it. Just let it be as it is. And whatever feelings come up, simply notice if there is any tension in them. Don't try to change the situation in which you feel. Just notice any tension, pushing or pulling or thickness in the mind or heart. And if you see some, just gently invite it to soften. Just relax into it. Notice if there's any tenderness underneath. And if so, relax into that tenderness. Notice if there's any openness or spaciousness beneath tenderness. And if so, relax into that sense of space. And let that spaciousness soak into your being. Savor it. May it be so. Blessed be. Namaste.
Well, we could take any questions for Doug and or comments. And if you want to either virtually or you can raise your hand in the comment section, or you can, in the attendee section, or you can just raise your hand. And I'm going to switch my view so I can see more people. Okay. I was thinking of something I had thought of a long time ago, Doug, with physical pain, and that was somebody had said, make friends with your pain to deal with it.
Yeah, it is sort of like that. And with physical pain, what happens is there is a strong sensation, and then there's the aversion. And you can't do anything directly about the sensation, although fighting it can make it worse. But if you can see the aversion as a separate mind quality, then you can allow the aversion You can find that to soften. And then the thing can lighten up quite a bit. And as we get older, we get to deal with pain a lot.
Yes, we do.
Sometimes I see myself as an old jalopy riding down the street with nuts and bolts falling off.
Ron, you had a, and Barbara, you both had comments.
Can you unmute yourselves?
Unmute. It turns out we can't unmute for you. You have to unmute yourselves.
Thanks for the reminder. I also need to be reminded to wear my mask sometimes. A lot of what you were describing, Reverend Kraft, it reminds me of the word acceptance. And I teach public speaking. I have a lot of people with stage fright, and they always want to fight it. And they hate that they feel it. And they look at me like I have three heads when I say, oh, look, here's this thing coming that you should recognize by now. Can you just welcome it in and use that energy? And I think both of us are asked, is acceptance a good word for what you're describing?
Yeah, it's tricky, though, because acceptance can have sort of cliched connotations. It's about just letting things be as they are. I don't know if any of you know Byron Katie, but she has a thing. She says, you know, if you fight reality, you lose, but only 100% of the time. And so it's just a matter of seeing of what's there, whether you like it or not, it's still there. And fighting it doesn't help. But I also know that public speaking is, probably goes to the core of a lot of people's care. After many, many years in the ministry, I was still a little bit nervous every time I get up to speak, but my pants had never actually fallen down or anything. So after a while, I just didn't take the fears seriously. There's this old saying that I love. It says that if you take a teaspoon of salt and you stir it into a glass of water, it makes the water so bitter you can't drink it. But if you stir the same teaspoon of salt into a 5-gallon cistern, you don't even notice it's there. There's nothing we can do to get rid of the salt, but we can make ourselves a bigger container. And usually, I mean, we can try this right now. Can I ask people if you can feel underneath whatever you're experiencing now, if you can feel back behind there a quiet sense of spaciousness. And the deal is, it's so quiet, it doesn't draw our attention, but it's already there. So it's not something we do to ourselves, but just kind of experience what may be quietly with us all the time. And public speaking just sort of goes to the core of our fears.
Yep. Barbara, you had something too.
Thank you so much, Doug. This was such a beautiful service. And okay. I used to meditate all the time. I ran a meditation group in my Universalist Unitarian Church in Syracuse. But I really haven't been. And having your little short guided meditation was so beautiful to me. And I have been meditating a little bit lately, but this is just exactly what I needed to see and hear and feel to guide myself back into that mode, which is so wonderfully helpful in my life. So thank you. And could I just ask you, who is that portrait behind you?
Oh, this one?
On the
yes,
wall.
Yes, right, on the wall.
The bookshelf wall.
Behind
yeah.
the book.
Oh, and there's another one over here.
We can't really see that one very well.
Yeah, it's kind of blurry. During the Senate Watergate hearings, I was out here in California, and I used to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning to see the beginning of them. And I got some drawing paper and pen and ink and stuff, and so I would sit there drawing as I was listening to the hearings. And so I had a photograph of a Pomo Indian
from Southern California that was taken in the 1890s. And so what I was trying to do with this was I thought that if I could get more detail in the picture than anybody could see, that it might come off the paper. So this was one of my experiments.
Very nice. Thank you.
And this one over here, which is harder to see, if you could, it may be familiar. It's a drawing of a picture from the Family of Man of a Depression era guy who was in the shadow, kind of looking, you know, up at the sky or something that I always found uplifting.
Thank you so much.
Mary.
Barbara, when you were talking, and maybe the next person, I was thinking of when I was at Camp Unistar, and one of the things we would do at Camp Unistar was climb up Unifer, which was a very tall, actually white pine tree. And the advice that one of the experienced campers gave me, or gave anyone who was climbing the tree, was think of the tree as your friend, and you'll have a better job. You'll find it much easier to climb if you think of it as your friend rather than your enemy that you have to conquer.
Yeah, I think the art of meditation, that so often people think it's trying to overcome the mind or try to, you know, conquer difficulty or something like that. When the secret is that how we relate to something doesn't change it in the moment, but over the long run, it's what has the most effect. So if you're kind to yourself, it doesn't change that moment, but over time, the mind, heart get kinder.
Anyone else have a question or comment?
Or objection.
Or objection. Okay, go ahead.
Hi. First, I want to say just thank you so much for offering this. Oh. And I really appreciated the meditation and everything that you spoke on. I was wondering, when you said to see if there was any tenderness, what does that word mean to you, or if anybody wants to share? I had my own idea of that, but I was curious to know, what does that mean to you when you say tenderness?
That's a great question. Yeah, I'd almost sort of rather hear what it means to other people, because the word means what it means to us, but I won't dodge it completely. I think for me, the tenderness is sort of related to a feeling of vulnerability and a willingness to be with that vulnerability with some open, some heartfulness. It's like you might be with a small child who wakes up from a nightmare. You know, you don't try to talk them out of the nightmare, but you just... So the tenderness is that... kind of soft openness that feels like, yeah, I can get hurt. I can get hurt.
Mary Franz. Shoot herself.
She's doing it.
Mary, you have to unmute yourself. It should be on the bottom Zoom toolbar if you like wiggle your mouse towards the bottom of the screen on the bottom left.
There we go.
Thank you. Thank you for your definition, because it's another meaning for tenderness. I'm a retired physician. When you examine a patient and they complain about a pain, you want to know if it's not too, and so you touch varying degrees of pressure on the sore, but the patient is noticing the pain, and maybe it isn't tender, and that points you in a different direction. So this tenderness is two definitions at least.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah, in psychotherapy, there's this phrase that's called readily accessible anxiety, which means that people may be all tied up with stuff, but if they can't feel, if their anxiety is not accessible, there's not too much you can do with it. So I could see with somebody with a pain, if it's not tender, you know, then it's not as accessible.
Yeah, I also, for me, it was about the child. Because there's this sense of innocence with mm-hmm. children that I think we all have in us, but it's maybe easier to have that compassion towards children. But as adults, like, we don't give ourselves that sense of care, like our inner child with ourselves or each other. But yeah, so for me, it was like what is my... almost like holding myself as I was as a child or something.
Yeah.
Randy?
I just want to continue the Doug's introductory comment, and it dovetails on the last speaker was saying that if one is in touch with one's tenderness and vulnerability, then I think one can extend that to other people, to look at other people as vulnerable, even though what their words are and their actions might be counterproductive to those kinds of feelings for them. I think it encourages us to do that. And I think that's one of the real hopes that meditating across the board, across the world, can be very helpful. If that vulnerability that we experience for ourselves, we can look at other people's having that same vulnerability. And I think our connections with them would be vastly different.
Hear, hear.
Rick? Yeah. Rick, you had a comment?
I've got so many, but I'll try and hold it. The tenderness and, you know, embracing your pain is kind of like the pain inside your mouth where you rub your tongue over it, and it kind of gives you some security when you do that. You embrace it. That's one thing, I think. Randy's a superior person to me. I'm the kind of person that's looking for the bear. And, from earlier in your discussion, I think I'll just stop there.
Oh, I want to hear about looking for the bear.
Well, if you would, it would be feeling responsible for your world in a tangible sense, being ready to... defend yourself and others in a harsh world. I think I'm pretty good to myself. And so I enjoyed that comment you had about that, how that opens you up to more generosity for others. And this is where Randy and I kind of come to an agreement in the sense of having a little more generosity to yourself gives you the opportunity to be more generous to others. If the person had stiffed me with the extra 9 yogis, I might have taken some more practical aspects and said, well, do you want to pay for these 18 people? Because we're going to have to cancel this because I can't do, I can't provide a substandard experience to them without you, with you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyway. All right.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, one of the things that I do sometimes is, we all get very good at even unconsciously sort of masking our faces, even if that's not our intention. But the hardest place to mask is actually the outer corners of the eyes. And I learned this years and years ago. I ran a counseling center for street kids, and just a lot of really tough kids. And so when they were coming in and I was looking at them, I'd always check out the corners of their eyes. And you could see this, you know, hard facade, and then this little bitty kid, scared kid, sort of peeking out of the corner of the eyes. And then I could talk to, I could actually address the scared kid, if I didn't do it too obviously, but just sort of hold that on my heart as I was talking to him and Noah was there. And when we do that, you know, and look around at other people, the sense of separation between all of us just tends to go down.
Any last questions or comments?
You'd be willing to move to Madison? We're in need of a minister.
Thank you. It's very tempting. I love Madison, and one of my meditation teachers used to say that that I was very ambitious, and I sort of chafed against it, except I really trusted him, and I began to see that. And actually, these days, my ambition is going down. I was minister to a church out here with, we had 300 members and about 500 people who were actively involved in it. And at kind of first, I just loved kind of working with all of those dynamics. And I don't anymore. I really love, you know, talking, you know, deeply with people about what's going on, but all the business of maintaining an institution has lost all its appeal. Maybe I'm growing up. I don't know.
We all are. Oh, thank you so much, Doug. And Doug is going to read the closing words.
May we turn towards whatever life brings us. Relax into our experience and savor any uplift, no matter how small or large. May it be so. Blessed be.
Thank you so much.